This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Fulfilling prophecy where many of the people who go on to excel in sports choose the more lucrative sports, and that's basketball and football. And then ultimately, kids in the inner city, especially African American kids, don't see anybody who looks like them in Major League Baseball. And it's a cycle that has now led to a steep decline in the number of African Americans who are in Major League Baseball. And I think that that's part of what you see in the background going on in this story, A Chance to Win. And it's part of the difficulty that Rodney, the main character, has in developing and building this team, is that kids just don't play. He's starting with people who have never even picked up a glove, let alone own one.
When you started writing this book, I'm just curious to know the differences you have seen in New Jersey, which is not exactly one of the wealthiest states in the country, since before the crash versus afterwards. I mean, it doesn't portray itself as a very wealthy state, and I can't imagine the economy is doing it any favors. What have you seen in terms of how people are living the kind of lives like Mr. Mason have been going through?
Well, New Jersey is actually a study in extreme contrasts. Newark has been one of the most hard-hit areas of the country by the not only the economic crisis, but more specifically the foreclosure crisis. And even more specifically, the South Ward, where this book takes place, has had an inordinately high proportion of people who have lost their homes. That's one example of how the economic crisis impacts inner cities on a disproportionate level. But New Jersey, as a whole, is a relatively wealthy state, and just a few miles away from Newark, where a lot of these struggles are happening, are very wealthy suburbs. And there's always been this dichotomy in which Newark is almost ignored or forgotten by people who live in places just a few miles away. And that is ultimately one of the things that inspired me to write this story, is that I wanted to tell the story of a real community with real people, not necessarily following the stereotypical image of Newark, of urban dysfunction, but of people trying to build a community and maintain a community. And those stories, I believe, do not get told enough.
How did you meet Mr. Mason?
I met Mr. Mason in 2005 while I was working on a story for the Star-Ledger as a crime reporter about victims of gun violence. I wanted to explore the physical and emotional trauma that gun violence puts on a community. And I was introduced to him by an anti-violence activist. He was a mutual acquaintance. He introduced me to Mr. Mason in the early 2005. And ultimately, Rodney became part of the story that I wrote later that year. And we maintained contact from time to time for many years after that, until 2008, when he decided to coach this baseball team, is when we really developed a close relationship.
In your story, you talk about how Rodney was shot by a drive-by shooter, and then for almost a decade, he didn't do much except sit in his wheelchair and stare outside all day. As I was reading that, I was wondering, first, was his shooter ever caught?
His shooter actually was. It took a while for them to track him down, but ultimately he was found and pleaded guilty and did a prison term.
And the other thing I was wondering, you know, when I was thinking about so many other victims of gun violence and drive-by shootings where their shooters are never caught, I just wondered, what would it be like to sit in a wheelchair and wonder if your shooter is driving by looking at you, you know, while you're sitting there knowing that there's not really a whole lot you can do about it?
Yeah, it's a very good point that you make. And that happened twice to him, you could argue. First of all, during the period of time right after he was shot, there was definitely that fear that this guy was still out there. He obviously had tried to kill Rodney. Had failed, and Rodney was left living with this fear that this person would come back and try to finish the job. And ultimately, the shooter was caught, pleaded guilty, went to prison, served a prison term, and then was released. And so several years down the line, I think it was 7 years down the line, Rodney gets a letter from the prosecutor's office saying that the shooter has been released. We're letting you know that. And so now that perhaps he is going to come back again. He doesn't know where this guy is. And when I first met Rodney in early 2005, as I mentioned, he expressed that fear to me, that he wasn't sure. He was scared to get on the bus. He was scared to go out in public, in part because he didn't know if he was going to run into this guy again.
Right. Every now and then you read a redemption story like this that either comes out of poor neighborhoods or untenable situations. What amazes you more as a writer? That people fall into these situations and these bad circumstances, or that they have the perseverance to rise out of them?
Definitely the latter. I have become fascinated through my work, not only working on this book, but more in general, writing about crime and other aspects of life in Newark, about the resiliency of people, particularly children. I am amazed to this day at what children can go through and still be able to focus on school and still be able to become relatively well-adjusted socially and become productive adults. Children in many situations in Newark go through things that nobody should rightfully go through, and it amazes me that they're able to make it through so well. There's something about the human spirit that I think a lot of these people's stories come through in the book, and it doesn't just go for children as well. I mean, Rodney has been about through as bad of an experience as any person can go through, and he somehow finds a way to keep getting up and pursuing a new dream of his. And I also follow a father who has spent time in jail, spent time on the streets, and because he is now a father of five, he has totally changed around his life, dedicated himself 100% to working, and it's very inspiring for me personally, and I hope readers also get inspired by this, to see the resiliency of the human spirit through these characters' lives.
You talked about children earlier, and I was really interested in two of the kids in your book, Derek and Dewan. Can you talk about how they compare and contrast with each other?
Derek and Dewan have certain similarities in their experiences. The similarities are that the main one that I explore in the book is that they don't live with their fathers. And this is something that both explicitly and implicitly manifest themselves in the struggles that they go through. It starts from the beginning when I start writing about their experiences playing baseball, and these are not kids who have learned baseball from their fathers. Baseball is the type of sport that traditionally is handed down from father to child, and they haven't had that experience. They have to figure it out for themselves in other ways, Rodney Mason, the coach, being one of them. Fatherhood is the main connecting theme of these two boys. But they also go along different paths. Dewan has his biological mother at home, and she's a very strong presence at home, and she does an amazing job in providing for him, given the limitations, and guides him into a charter school in neighborhoods where the public schools are not very good. Charter schools are a potential option, and she finds him, almost single-handedly wills him into a highly regarded charter school, and Dewan thrives in that environment. By contrast, Derek doesn't have the benefit of having his biological mother, who passes away early on in the book, and bounces around to various other houses run by family members who love him deeply, but struggle to give him the kind of attention that, say, Dewan enjoys from his biological mother. And that instability impacts him in profound ways. He has a propensity for violent outbursts. Not that he hurts anybody, but he scares them as a young boy. And his family wonders if the instability has much to do with it. They know that they need to find him a more stable, permanent home if he's ever going to grow up healthy. And so you have the study in contrast where you see the importance of, if you don't have your father at home, you need some stability. And you see the results of that through their experiences.
Being this intimate in the lives of Derek and Dewan and Rodney, did it ever feel like voyeurism? Like I'm seeing too much? Like I shouldn't be seeing this?
There were times where I felt like I was seeing too much. There were times where, to their credit, they trusted me. We built up a mutual trust in which there was very little filter, if you will, between what I was reporting and what I was experiencing just in general in life. And as a reporter, you need to decide, there's a fine line that you need to maintain between, as you said, I guess, voyeurism and writing a relevant story. And you need to filter out what is appropriate and relevant to the story to maintain the arc and what is just sheer, just exposing a piece of drama in someone's life just for the sake of your being there. And so that was a part of the writing and reporting and editing process, that I wanted to make sure that I told a fair and accurate story and didn't just rely on just every piece of dramatic flair that I experienced.
So was it hard to turn off the objective writer and turn on the empathetic writer?
It was difficult at first. When you're a newspaper reporter, it's fairly easy and it's ingrained in your professional career to maintain a certain distance between yourself and the person that you're writing about. But when you embark on a project such as the one that I embarked on, where you're spending hours and hours and days and weeks and months and years ultimately with individual people, getting to know them, I got to know their families, they got to know my family, you can't help, you're human, you cannot help but developing a deep relationship with them and caring for them very deeply. And I found it difficult to maintain that objectivity. The great thing about being able to write a book is that you, and this is what I did, you can allow that objectivity to drop a little bit so you can explain more about what it is that these people are going through your own personal viewpoints. And that's what I tried to do. And there were points where I could not deny that I was part of the story. I cared very deeply for them. And there were times where I gave them rides or tried to help them negotiate some government bureaucracy, for example. And I wanted to be able to show people through my eyes what I was seeing. And I felt like that was the most natural and honest way to do it. So in the end, it became what was first a difficult decision to drop some of that objectivity became a very liberating process for me, where I was able to write about things as I honestly saw them.
Have you always wanted to write a book?
It was not something that I always imagined wanting to do or even being able to do. And in retrospect, that is one of the things that I am most proud of, is that this story came about organically from my work as a beat reporter at a newspaper. One of the things that I tell other people who are considering writing a book is that you need to have a lot of passion for your subject. You need to believe in your subject, because you're going to be spending long years on this subject, going back over hours of interviews and writing and rewriting and rewriting again. You need to love the subject. And I had the benefit of coming across some people who I cared very deeply about, and I never got tired of talking to them or writing about them, and I still believe in their story.
Are you a good reader? Because I've read that good writers tend to be good readers. Do you think that's true?
I think it's true, and I think also the process of writing, for instance, a book, makes you a better reader, especially when it comes to nonfiction. I now read nonfiction in a much more intense way. When I read nonfiction now, I am thinking through how that writer developed the story and how that person gathered his or her facts. And I think I'm a slower reader now because I spend so much time analyzing how that material was developed. At the same time, as a writer, I also read a lot of fiction in which I try to draw a lot of lessons of fictional style storytelling and apply that to nonfiction, and that was what I tried to do in A Chance to Win. So I'm a much more intense reader now than I was even before I started to set out on this book.
The Anthony J. Lucas Work in Progress Award is given through a cooperation between Columbia School of Journalism and Harvard University. It's for American nonfiction writers. Tell me about how you found out you won it, and tell me why you think you won it.
Tony Lucas was an incredible reporter who won a Pulitzer at the New York Times, but also, most importantly, won a Pulitzer for his book about the Boston school busing crisis. And it was suggested that I apply by my agent, and it being a very prestigious award, I didn't think I had much of a chance of winning it. But I submitted my proposal. It was a work-in-progress award. It was something that is given out before the book is produced. And so I submitted a cover letter in my proposal, and I assumed, of course, that I wasn't going to win it. And then I got a phone call a few months later. I think it was in early 2010, and I was shocked. There was no other way to describe it. Being a natural cynic, I assumed that nobody else applied for it. And it turned out that they had had, at the time, a record number of submissions. And the award, I came to believe the reason that I won the award was because of what I just described to you. Tony Lucas was somebody who had a passion for being able to tell the story of cities, telling the story of cities through individual stories. And Common Ground, his book about Boston, is a perfect example of that. And I believe the judges saw in my book somewhat of a similarity in that it came about as a result of my beat work in a city and going through a lot of struggle, similar to Boston at the time when Anthony Lucas wrote about Boston, and also that it came about as a result of my developing of characters that spoke of larger, more universal themes about the state of contemporary cities. I think that they saw similarities in the way that I approached my subjects and the way that Tony Lucas approached his.
How's Rodney and his team doing?
He often wonders how he can keep doing this, teaching the game to kids who have no idea how to play. He often says, "I'm getting too old for this," and I have to tell him, "No, this is your life's project. This is what you're so good at. You need to keep doing it." And he realizes that. But there are times, of course, when I'm sure any coach experiences extreme frustration at the difficulty of teaching a game to kids who have never played it before. But the team is doing well. He's fielding a team right now of a dozen or so kids. They just started their season. I think they are 1-1, and Rodney feels good about their chances, but there's a lot of room for improvement, as always.
You know, you spent your whole life reporting on how a single decision can change your life, and we talked earlier about different parts of New Jersey economically and socially. Have you ever looked at life and the struggles that the people you report on are going through and thought, "There but for the grace of God go I"?
Yes, I believe that. It makes me personally appreciate the second chances that you get in life when you come from a place of relative privilege, when you don't have second chances in places like Newark. It totally changes the trajectory of your life. It comes about from having opportunities or the lack of opportunities, and how it ultimately affects your abilities to recover from them. I mean, Rodney started dealing drugs because he felt like he had no other options. He was hungry. And, of course, that was the wrong thing to do, but he felt at the time that was his only option. And there was nobody there to guide him in another way. He has often talked to me about the fact that he didn't have a father at home. He wished he had somebody to tell him, no, you're not going out and doing that anymore. He wished he had that kind of discipline. It's the type of thing that I know I myself have taken for granted from my own experience in my own life. You get a lot of second chances when you come from a place where there's more opportunity. And I can only imagine how I would have survived in the same situation that Rodney or some of the boys are living in.
Has this book changed you in any way?
It's changed me in a couple of ways, and it feels quite gratifying to admit this. I became a new father at the time that I began working on this book.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. My daughter is now 4 years old, so it's been a while, but I believe that I became a better father because of the people who I spent time with. I saw from the perspective of kids who look up to the adults in their lives, and I see the effect of when you promise something to a kid and you don't deliver. And so that has been one of my guiding principles in my life as a father, is that never promise something that you can't deliver on. I have been inspired by one of the characters, Tae Kwon, who is a father with a dark past who has turned it all around to dedicate himself to his family. I have told him many times, I call him every Father's Day and say, Happy Father's Day. You're one of my favorite dads. I take inspiration from his dedication to his family. And so that is the biggest impact that this book has had on my personal life, is my role as a father.
Well, Mr. Shupi, I want to thank you for the conversation. And please tell people the name of your book and where they can find it.
The book is called A Chance to Win, and you can find it at any traditional brick-and-mortar store, online stores like Amazon. You can go to my website, jonathanshupi.com.
Okay, Mr. Shupi, thanks again.
Thanks for your time.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I'm Don Merrill, and I've been talking with author Jonathan Shupi. Mr. Shupi has written a new book called A Chance to Win, a story of redemption from the streets of Newark, New Jersey. Thanks for listening.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Thursday, May 30th. I'm Kristen Yount. The White House has selected former U.S. Deputy Attorney General Jim Comey to head the Federal Bureau of Investigation. He served during the Bush administration and was a top federal prosecutor in New York State. Fellow Republican Senator Charles Grassley asserts that Comey will have to answer for his role in U.S. policy regarding advanced interrogation techniques and the torture memos. His other jobs include legal counsel to a hedge fund company and senior vice president and general counsel for Lockheed Martin, the defense contractor. Lisa Monaco also appeared on the Justice Department's shortlist for the FBI position. Monaco currently serves as the White House anti-terrorism advisor. The California Senate voted to revoke the nonprofit tax-exempt status from groups like the Boy Scouts that discriminate based on sexual orientation or religious views. Democratic Senator Ricardo Lara lauded the Boy Scouts of America's announcement earlier this month to accept openly gay youth to join the Scouts. However, the Senate agreed with Laura's assertion that excluding gay Scout leaders constitutes a flaw so profound that until it is fully fixed, it means that they are out of line with the values of California and should be ineligible for a tax benefit paid for by all Californians. What good is it to save the planet if humanity suffers? Asked ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson at the annual shareholders meeting yesterday. At this meeting, shareholders voted down a proposed resolution that would require the company to set greenhouse gas emission standards. Tillerson proposes that energy giant ExxonMobil has the technology and resources to combat any fallout from fossil fuel drilling, piping, and refinery with their own engineering products and eliminating the need for limits. Only 19% of shareholders voted yes on a proposal to ban discriminating against openly especially gay people in the workplace. Former Environmental Protection Agency Chief Lisa Jackson has accepted a position of Vice President of Environmental Initiatives for tech giant Apple. She's tasked with eliminating Apple's ever-growing carbon footprint. While directing the EPA, she championed fights to reduce mercury emissions, stop mountaintop removal mining, and to strongly regulate power plant emissions. The weather in Portland today is rainy off and on, but also clearing up around 7 p.m., highs in the low 60s. This has been KBOO News at Noon. I'm Kristen Yount. Tune in every weekday at 5 p.m. for the latest in local, national, and international news produced by volunteers in our Portland studios.
And you're tuned to Community Radio, KBOO Portland. 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, 100.7 FM Corvallis and Albany. And we are at K220 HR Hood River and K264 AA Corvallis. Good afternoon and welcome to the World Beat Connection. I'm your host, DJ Charlie. This is your connection to Afro-Caribbean sounds on Community Radio KBOO from noon until 2 p.m. this afternoon. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at our carbon-neutral eco-brew pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com. It's good to be back again. After a two-week hiatus, as you know, I share the space with Shucks of Sheba. We alternate on Thursdays, so got a show lined up for you this afternoon. We're going to be hearing a couple more selections from the Ivory Coast Soul double CD that I started last show. Very, very fine tracks from that country. We're going to explore some IRE tracks from the Platinum Reggae series that was released back in 2001 on the Artists Only label. Some very interesting Jamaican tracks on that. We've got some tickets to give away later on in the show, so stay tuned for that. We're going to be hearing some salsa from Tiempo Libre and some Latin funk from the Diablos del Ritmo CD. And then we're going to be catching up with a couple of exciting new releases. One of them brings Calypso into the modern era, right up to 2013. I think you'll enjoy that. Plus, Bollywood meets Nigeria in the city of Kano, and that's coming up too. So we're going to start off the show this afternoon with some tracks from, a track anyway, from the raw sounds of Burkina Faso. This is called Bambara Mystic Soul. This goes back to the mid-1970s, a great, great era, decade in African music. And we're going to be hearing a track called Tink Tank by the Afro Soul System right here on Community Radio, KBOO 90.7 FM, on the web at kboo.fm.